Reading from the Acts of the Apostles. Now in Joppa there was a disciple whose name was Tabitha, which in Greek is Dorcas. She was devoted to good works and acts of charity. At that time she became ill and died. And when they'd washed her, they laid her in a room upstairs. And since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples who heard that Peter was there sent two men with the request, "Please come to us without delay." And so Peter got up and went with them, and when he arrived, he took them to the room upstairs. All the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing tunics, other clothing Dorcas had made while she was with them. Peter put all of them outside, and then he knelt down and prayed. He turned to the body and said, "Tabitha, get up." And when she opened her eyes and seeing Peter, she sat up. He gave her his hand and helped her up. Then calling the saints and widows, he showed her to be alive. This became known throughout Joppa. Many believed in the Lord. Meanwhile, he stayed in Joppa for some time with a certain Simon, a tanner. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever, the word of the Lord. What happens when your story gets lost between the headlines? But it happens, doesn't it? Sometimes the important stories sort of suck all the oxygen out of the room, leaving everything else to seem like a footnote. I mean, think about our text for today. Now, Acts, the book itself, is packed with major plot points. In chapter 8, right, just before our chapter for today, chapter 8, we're cruising with Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. Then, as chapter 9 opens up, we have Saul, who's hell-bent on violence, blinded by the light in his Damascus Road experience. And then chapter 10 unveils Peter's vision and his journey to Cornelius, a Gentile soldier. So those are three chapters, and those are three seismic shifts in Christianity. Three chapters, three big narratives: Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, Paul on the Damascus Road, and Peter and Cornelius, the Gentile. I mean, there's a lot going on there over three chapters. And those are all pretty heavy hitters, wouldn't you say? A lot of history tied up in those stories. It's not just boring, we learn it because it's going to be on the test kind of history either. These are important. I mean, Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, the conversion of Saul into Paul, Peter and Cornelius, these stories shaped the very life of the early church. I mean, we wouldn't be stretching it at all to say that the church as we know it wouldn't exist without these stories. And wedged in there between these epic accounts is this little story of the healing of Aeneas, which is just before our text, and then this little story of the raising of Dorcas. Now, I say little story, by which I do not mean insignificant, although I fear, as an apparent sapling in the shadow of three such towering redwoods, Dorcas does have she gets kind of short shrift. But what I really mean by little story is exactly that. It's little. It's brief. It doesn't take up much room. It's small. It's almost an afterthought, really. So why is it in here? Well, let's don't give up on Dorcas too quick. For one thing, she's one of only five people named as a disciple, either in Acts or Luke. You know who else gets named as a disciple in this two-volume narrative? James and John in the book of Luke. Ananias, right, who helps Paul with his conversion. and then Timothy in the book of Acts. I mean, that's pretty stellar company that Dorcas finds herself in, isn't it? She's at least, according to Luke, no small timer, no bit part player in this drama. She's a disciple. Indeed, Dorcas is the only woman in the whole Christian scriptures to whom the word disciple is directly attached. Very few people get such special treatment in the Bible. So Luke wants us to understand that the church suffered a devastating blow when news came down that Dorcas had died. I mean, she's not just a member of First Christian Joppa's Tuesday Afternoon Bridge Club. She's the straw that stirs the drink. So Luke can name Dorcas in the same breath as Philip and Paul and Peter with a clear conscience. Because within her sphere of influence, Dorcas is a heavy hitter, just like those guys. But her stature within the young Christian community isn't the primary point that Luke seeks to make. Although he does want us to know that this new enterprise called the church has some rather revolutionary ideas when it comes to women. I mean, in a culture in which women were, by and large, still considered property, the church suddenly put forward the subversive notion that, you know, women, they're pretty good leaders, too. In other words, from the very beginning, those who follow Jesus are schooled to trust women to make good decisions. We're supposed to trust women to make good decisions. That we ought to have confidence in women's abilities to exercise their moral agency over their lives, their vocations, their families, their own bodies. All of that is encoded in the DNA of those who want to live as Jesus lived. However, Luke's primary point, which he's looking to underline with this sort of narrative mastery here, is encapsulated in a single word. That's it. Luke ties together all of these big and small narratives with a single word. Now, it doesn't jump out, probably because you're reading in the English translation. But if you were hearing these stories read to you in the original Greek, and assuming you spoke Greek, you'd hear something quite extraordinary. Luke ties these stories together with the same word he uses to announce Easter: resurrection. Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, the conversion of Saul, the healing of Aeneas, the raising of Dorcas, and the conversion of Cornelius hinge on normal, everyday resurrection. And I hear you say, all right, wait a minute. I mean, I can see how you might, like, twist the whole raising of Dorcas thing into a resurrection moment because, I mean, even though I don't see that word in the text, because after all, she is sort of raised from the dead, so I get that one. But I don't know. I mean, I think you're stretching on the other stories. I don't see resurrection with Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, conversion of Saul, the healing of Aeneas, or the conversion of Cornelius. I mean, you're just making this stuff up. No, it's in the book. It's resurrection. It's in there, I'm telling you. Where? All right. Well, let's start with the obvious one, Dorcas. Luke tells us that Dorcas has gone on to her eternal reward, causing some disciples to approach Peter and tell him that, you know, Dorcas is gone. And shades reminiscent of Jesus' raising of Jairus' daughter, Peter arrives on the scene and tells Dorcas to get up. Actually, he uses her Aramaic name, Tabitha, but the gist of it is that he tells her to get up. That, of course, is a normal, everyday resurrection. But the other stories, they have them too. How about Philip back in chapter 8? Luke tells us, then an angel of the Lord said to Philip, get up and go to the south, toward the south to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. It's a wilderness road. And so he got up and he went. Now there was an Ethiopian eunuch. ... Did you hear it in there? There's a resurrection in there. All right, what about Saul's conversion story in chapter 9? Where's there a resurrection in that? Well, actually, there are two. Saul, as you remember, was struck down on the road to Damascus by a bright light and the voice of Jesus. A little wobbly, perhaps, but Luke says Saul got up from the ground, and though his eyes were open, he could see nothing. And then Ananias, one of those select disciples named in Acts, is approached by God in a vision afterwards. And God says, "Ananias?" And he answered, "Here I am, Lord." And the Lord said to him, "Get up and go to the street called Straight at the house of Judas for a man of Tarsus named Saul." There it is. It's right there. It's there again. After Saul becomes Paul in chapter 9, we have this short account of Peter meeting a man named Aeneas who'd been bedridden for 8 years with paralysis. And Peter said to him, "Aeneas, Jesus Christ has healed you. Get up and make your bed." And resurrection happens again. As we've already discussed, Luke tells us about Dorcas. Just after Peter's encounter with Dorcas in Joppa, he had a dream about eating unclean food in chapter 10. And the upshot of this dream was that the voice that said, "What God has made clean, you should not call profane." Now, Luke leaves us with Peter kind of scratching his head, because Peter says, while Peter was greatly puzzled about what to make of the vision that he had seen, suddenly the men sent by Cornelius, who was a Gentile centurion, who also ironically would have been called unclean by Peter, these men show up on Peter's doorstep. They're asking for Simon's house. So while he was looking, still thinking about the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Hey, bud, look, three men are searching for you. Get up, go down, and go out with them without hesitation, for I have sent them." It's resurrection. All of these stories, they have it all in common. And that is, if the characters in these stories stay where they are, the work that God has for them to do won't get done. If they lie there on the ground, relaxing, struggling, frightened, paralyzed, dead, puzzling, then they're not going to accomplish what God wants. But they don't stay on the ground, do they? What do? They all get up. It's resurrection. And you say, I think you may be stretching that one a little bit. I mean, I get it, see your point, but just getting up doesn't really qualify as resurrection, does it? I mean, come on, Dorcas, all right, we give you Dorcas, but maybe even Aeneas and Saul with the conversion thing, but Philip and Peter, I mean, they just got up. And getting up isn't resurrection. Are you sure? It's the same word in Greek. Anistemi. The word we translate "get up" in English is the same word that we use to talk about the resurrection of Jesus on Easter. Literally, Jesus was gotten up by God on Easter Sunday morning. Luke artfully conveys that in all of these stories, stories that are central to the very spread of the gospel and the establishment of the church, God is busy accomplishing God's purposes in normal, everyday resurrections among ordinary people. I mean, God keeps dropping Easter into the unlikeliest of places. My father, a farmer's son, suffered from hay fever. That's how I began my dad's eulogy. I wanted, by that, to point out the interesting contradictions in his life. I knew my dad. I grew up in his presence. I thought I had a pretty good handle on who he was and who, by my estimation, he could never quite figure out who to be. But to me, he seemed like an ordinary guy, full of the usual human frailties that we all carry around with us. It's difficult to romanticize those folks who are closest to us, since we know what they look like before they brush their teeth in the morning or after they bark their shins on the coffee table. It's hard to idealize that. But burying my father was an interesting exercise in seeing his life through other people's eyes. I had countless folks make a point of coming to me and say that my dad who was an acquisitions editor for a publisher, that my dad was somehow responsible in helping them launch their careers as authors, which very gratifying to hear, but not entirely unexpected given the nature of his work, right? But more people came to tell me how he'd helped them find God through his patience and gentleness. Interestingly enough, my father struck me as neither patient nor gentle. In fact, neither of those words would have been ones that my siblings or I would have ever used to describe my dad. But they kept coming up over and over again in other people's descriptions of him. How my dad helped people find new life, or at least the life that they were meant to lead, which may amount to the same thing in the end. But I find it fascinating and not a little bit instructive to think that God can make something out of us that nobody ever thought we could be. Knowing ourselves as we do, that God chooses us to embody the love and justice envisioned in this new reign that's announced by Jesus. But if when God tells us to get up, we get up and go, regardless of who we are, then the story of the gospel is that God can change the world through us if we just get up and go. And that's the thing. The world, as chaotic and torn as it is right now, needs a little resurrection. Needs people like you and me to get up and bring new life to the folks who feel like everybody else has given up on them. LGBTQ kids are dying waiting for somebody to care about them. Traumatized refugees and asylum seekers are languishing in camps waiting for somebody to notice. Our black friends and family are dying in jails waiting for someone to realize that we seem to live in a system designed not to deliver, but to thwart justice. Single parents trapped in low-paying jobs wait for enough people to stand up with them and say, you know, you really can't live on $7.25 an hour. Muslims who live right here around us in fear. They're looking to see if people like you and me will wrap our arms around them and treat them like neighbors, like family. Here's the thing. These stories in Acts aren't about Philip or Paul or Peter or Aeneas or Dorcas, or stories about a farmer's son with ragweed allergies. These are stories about a God who constantly seeks to raise us up to do the work that God needs in this new realm of peace and justice that God's busy creating right now. The point of these normal, everyday resurrections is that God doesn't need much to work with to bring good news of the gospel to a dying world. Philip, the eunuch, Saul, Aeneas, Peter, Ananias, Cornelius, Dorcas, my father, you, me. Indeed, Luke says that if God is determined to oversee a resurrection moment with one of us, you, me, well, then not even death can keep us from getting up. Amen.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please rate the podcast on iTunes, retweet the link, or just tell your friends. Godspeed until next time on the Douglas Boulevard Christian Church Podcast.